And now, poet James Merrill, as he read from his own work as part of the 1969 Glasscock Poetry Contest held in May at Mount Holyoke College. Mr. Merrill has published 4 books of poetry, 2 plays, The Immortal Husband and The Bait, and 2 novels, The Seraglio and The Diblo's Notebook. His last book of poems, Nights and Days, received a National Book Award.
2 poems, one quite short, one longish, both written at the difficult age of 35. The first I read only because the central character reappears under an assumed name in the second. It's a poem about my late cat. And at the end, you should remember the final scene of Tosca when she jumps over the parapet of the Castel Sant'Angelo after being variously betrayed. Maisie. One morning I shall find I have slept with your full weight upon my heart, your motors and my breathing reconciled. The edges of the blind, the crack beneath the door will have blanched with day, the walls will be about to jar apart, and sun to dust my lids deep in the opened flower, and still I shall not have sent you away. When you came home without your sex, you hid in the cupboard under the sink. Its gasps and gurglings must have helped somehow. The second noon you ventured forth, a silent star, furred up to tragic eyes, hazarding recognition in a restaurant. It was horrible to see how much you honestly cared about food and comfort. The dishes refused, the chairs tried one by one. Eunuch and favorite both, you loll about, exuding that old magic there is mercifully no longer a market for. For the good of the guest who has not yet looked over the roof garden's brink to the eaves just below, you shudder there long enough only to shriek, if eyes could shriek, and if they were ever eyes, those chalcedony bonfires, O Scarpia, avanti a Dio, then plummet from view, leaving the newcomer aghast and weak. This next poem, and last, is called The Thousand and Second Night. It takes the form of a kind of notebook or travel journal kept over quite a long time. It begins in Istanbul in March and ends somewhere back here the following winter. There are several false endings to the poem. There's some pedantic apparatus and quotations interspersed. I think most of the trouble is in the first section. There's some references that I suppose most of you know, but anyhow, Hagia Sophia is the great mosque, the great church of Justinian, now a mosque. Dahin, dahin is a refrain from Goethe. The hammam is a Turkish bath. The lukum is a Turkish delight. The first section is called Rigor Vitae. It began because I had a strange illness. The technical term is Bell's palsy, but it's simply the temporary paralysis of a facial nerve. Istanbul, 21 March. I woke today with an absurd complaint. The whole right half of my face refuses to move. I have to laugh watching the rest of it reel about in dismay under the double burden, while its twin sags on, though sentient, stupefied. I'm here alone, not quite. Through fog outside loom winged letters, Pan-American. 2,500 years this city has stood between the passive Orient and our frantic West. I see no reason to be depressed. There are too many other things I haven't seen, like Hagia Sophia. Tea drunk, shaved and dressed, Dahin, Dahin. The house of heavenly wisdom first became a mosque, is now a flameless void. The apse, militantly dislocated, still wears those dark green epaulettes on which, to the pilgrim who forgets his Arabic, a wild script of gold whips has scribbled glowering, dated slogans, God is my grief, perhaps, or Byzantine, go home. Above you, the great dome, bald of mosaic, senile, floated in a gilt wash, its old profusion's hypnotic shimmer back and forth between that of the abacus, that of the nebula, had been picked up from the floor, the last of numberless handfuls, by the last 18th century visitor. You did not want to think of yourself for once, but you had held your head erect too many years within such transcendental skulls as this one, not to feel the usual, if no longer flattering, kinship. You'd let go learning and faith as well. You too had wrecked your precious sensibility. What else did you expect? Outdoors, uprooted, turban-crested stones lie side by side. It's as I might have feared. The building, desperate for youth, has smeared all over its original fine bones acres of ochre plaster. A diagram indicates how deep in the mud pack the real facade is. I want my face back, a pharmacist advises the hammam. After the hour of damp heat, one is addressed in gibberish, shown into a marble cell, and thrown on marble there to be scrubbed clean, is wrapped in towels and a sheet, and led upstairs to this lean tomb made all of panes, red, amber, green, with a glass star hung in the gloom. Here sits effaced by gem-like moods, tastes neither coffee nor lucum, and to the attendant who intrudes, or archaeologist, or thief, gravely uptilts one's mask of platinum, still dripping in a sign of life. And now what? Back, I guess, to the modern town. Midway across the bridge, an infantile memory promises to uncramp my style. I stop in deepening light to jot it down. On the crest of her wrist, by the black-watered silk of the watch band, his grandmother had a wen, a hard mauve bubble up from which bristled three or four white hairs. How often he had lain in her lap and been lulled to a rhythm easily the whole world's then, the yellowish sparkle of a ring marking its outer limit, while in the foreground, silhouetted like the mosque of Suleiman the Magnificent, mass and minarets felt by someone fallen asleep on the deck of his moored caique, that principal landmarks rise and fall, distinguished from any other, her beloved hand. Cold, a wind rising, an entire city dissolved by rhetoric. And out there, past the mirror of the Bosphorus, what black coast reflecting us into immobility? On this side, crowds, a magic lantern beam, Belgians on bicycles, housewives with red hair, masts, cries of crows blown high in the rose-blue air, Ataturk's tailcoat. It is like a dream, the death in life and life in death of Yeats' Byzantium, and if so, by the same token, alone in the sleepwalking scene, my flesh has woken and sailed for the fixed shore beyond the straits. The cure. The doctor recommended cortisone, diathermy, vitamins, and rest. It worked. These months in Athens, no one's guessed my little drama, I appear my own master again. However, once you've cracked that so-called mirror of the soul, it is not readily, if at all, made whole. Between the motion and the act falls the shadow, T.S. Eliot. Part of me has remained cold and withdrawn. The day I went up to the Parthenon, its humane splendor made me think, so what? One May noon in the Royal Park, among the flora of L'Agneau Mystique, cypress, mimosa, laurel, palm, a Greek came up to name them for me in his tongue. I thanked him. He thanked me, sat down. Peacocks trailed by, hard gray feet mashing overripe but bitter oranges. I knew the type, superb, male, raucous, unclean, orthodox, icon of appetite feathered to the eyes with the electric blue of days that will not come again. My friend with time to kill asked me the price of cars in paradise, by which he meant my country, for in his the stranger is a god in masquerade. Failing to act that part, I'm afraid I was not human either. Ah, who is? He is, or was, had brothers and a wife, chauffeured a truck, last Friday broke his neck against a tree. We have no way to check these headlong emigrations out of life. Try, I suppose, we must, as even Valerie said, and said more grandly than I ever shall, turning shut lids to the August sun and all such neon figments, amber, green, and red, of incommunicable energy, as in my blindness wake and at a blink vanish, and were the clearest hint, I think, of what I have been, am, and care to be. Carnivals. Three good friends in as many months have complained. You were nice, James, before your trip, or so I thought, but you have changed. I know, people do change. Well, I'm surprised, I'm pained. Before they disappeared into the night of what they said, I'd make a stab at mouthing promises that meant precisely nothing and never saved my face, for they were right. These weren't young friends, what's more. Youth would explain part of it. I have kept somewhere a page written at 16 to myself at twice that age, whom I accuse of having become the vain, flippant, unfeeling monster I now am to hear them talk, and exhorting me to recall starlight on an evening in late fall 1943 and the walk with M, to die in whose presence seemed the highest good. I met M and his new wife last New Year's. We rued the Cold War's tainted atmospheres from a corner table. It was understood our war was over. We had made our peace with everything. The heads of animals gazed in forbearance from the velvet walls. Great drifts of damask cleaned our lips of grease. Then L, her let's be friends, and her clear look returned in disbelief. I had heard of friends. I wanted love, if love's the word on the foxed spine of the long mislaid book. 1001 nights. They were grotesque. Stripping the blubber from my catch, I lit the oil-soaked wick, then could not see by it. Mornings a black film lay upon the desk. Where just a week ago I thought to delve for images of those years in a plain cover, some light verse happened as I looked them over. Postcards from Hamburg, circa 1912. The ocelots yawn, a sepia dim shamelessness from nun's coif to spike heels. She strokes his handlebar, who kneels to do for her what a dwarf does for him. The properties are grim, or you might want to say unsexed by use. A divan covered with a rug, a flat Methusalem of Krug appear from tableau to tableau. The next shows him with muscle flexed in resurrection from his underwear, gaining an underworld to harrow. He steers her ankles like like a wheelbarrow. The dwarf has slipped out for a breath of air, leaving the monstrous pair. Who are they? What does their charade convey? Maker and muse, demon and doll? All manners are symbolic, Hofmannsthal. Here's the dwarf back with cronies. Oh, I say, forget about it. They, in time, in pain, unlearned their tricks. Only the shrouded focuser of the lens may still be chasing specimens from his lone bathysphere deep in the Styx. St. Pauli's clock struck six. Sighing, the death of sin is wages. He paid his models, bade them dress and go, earthlings once more, incognito, down swarming boulevards, the contagiously easy final stages, dodged even by the faithful, one of whom, morose great-uncle Alastair, brought back these effigies and would shortly bear their doctrine, unconfessed, we may assume, into his brazen tomb. We found the postcards after her divorce, I and Aunt Alex. She turned red with shame, then white, then thoughtful. Ah, they're all the same. Men, I mean. A pause. Not you, of course. And then, we'll burn them, light the fire. I must meanwhile have tucked a few into my shirt. I spent the night rekindling with expert fingers, but that phase needn't be discussed. The soul, which in infancy could not be told from the body, came with age to resemble a body one no longer had, whose transports went far beyond what passes now for sensation. All irony aside, the libertine was in search of his soul. Nightly he labored to regain those firelit lodgings. Likewise, upon the earth's mature body, we inflict a wealth of gross experience. Drugs, drills, bombardments, with what effect? A stale frisson, a waste of resources all too analogous to our own. Natural calamities, tumor and apoplexy no less than flood and volcano, may at last be hailed as positive reassurances, perverse if you like, of life in the old girl yet. Germaine Naman. Faced with such constant bickering, Cynthia would have to pinch herself to recall how warmly and deeply those two did in fact love one another, A.H. Clarendon, Psyche's sisters. Love, warmth, fist of sunlight at last pounding emphatic on the gulf, high wails from your white ship, the heart prevails, affirm it, simple decency rides the blast, phrases that quick to smell blood lurk like sharks within a style's transparent lights and darks. The lips part, the plume trembles. You're afloat upon the breathing, all reflecting deep. The past recedes and twinkles, falls asleep. Fear is unworthy, say the stars by rote. What destinations have been yours till now? Unworthy, says the leaping prow. O skimmer of deep blue volumes fraught with rhyme and reason, once the phosphorescent meshes loosen and the objects of your quest slip through, almost you can overlook a risen brow, a thin black dawn on the horizon. Except that in this virgin hemisphere, one city calls you. Towers, drums, conches, bells, tolling each year's more sumptuous farewells to flesh. Among the dancers on the pier glides one figure in a suit of bones whose savage grace alerts the chaperones. He picks you out from thousands. He intends perhaps no mischief, yet the dog-brown eyes in the chalk face that stiffens as it dries pierce you with the eyes of those three friends. The mask begins to melt upon your face. A hush has fallen in the marketplace. And now the long adventure. Let that wait. I'm tired. It's late at night. Tomorrow, if it is given me to conquer an old distrust of imaginary scenes, scenes not lived through yet, the few final lines will lie on the page and the whole ride at anchor. I'm home, of course. It's winter. Real snow fills the road. On the unmade brass bed lies my adored Scheherazade, 8/9 asleep, tail twitching to the steel band of the steam heat's dissonant calypso. The wind has died. Where would I be if not here? There's so little left to see. Lost friends, my long ago voyages, I bless you for sore limbs and mouth kissed, face bronzed and lined, an earth held up, a text not wholly undermined by fluent passages of metaphor. Now, if the class will turn back to this poem's first section, Istanbul, I shall take what little time is left today to make some brief points. So, the rough pentameter quatrains give way, you will observe, to three interpolations, prose as well as verse. Does it come through how each in turn refers to mind, body, and soul, or memory? It does? Good. No, I cannot say offhand why this should be. I find it vaguely Yes, please. The poet quotes too much? That is one way to put it. Mightn't he have planned for his own modest effort to be seen against the yardstick of the truly great, in Spender's phrase? Fearing to overstate, he lets them do it, lets their words, I mean, enhance his... Yes, what now? Ah, how and when did he affirm? Why, constantly. And how else but in the form? Form's what affirms. That's well said, if I do. Bells ring. Go, gentlemen. And when the long adventure reached its end, I saw the Sultan in a glass grown old, while she, his fair wife still, her tales all told, smiled at him fondly. O my dearest friend, said she, and lord and master from the first, release me now. Your servant would refresh her soul in that cold fountain which the flesh knows not. Grant this, for I am faint with thirst. And he, but it is I who am your slave. Free me, I pray, to go in search of joys unembroidered by your high, soft voice along that stony path the senses pave. They wept, then tenderly embraced and went their ways. She and her fictions soon were one. He slept through moonset, woke in blinding sun, too late to question what the tale had meant.
James Merrill, reading from his work as part of the 1969 Glasscock Poetry Contest, which was held in May at Mount Holyoke College. Mr. Merrill has published 4 books of verse. His latest volume, Nights and Days, received a National Book Award. Mr. Merrill's plays include The Immortal Husband and The Bait, and he has also written 2 novels, The Seraglio and The Diblo's Notebook.